It's a delight to be here. I've never seen such a magnificent view of the Baltimore Harbor. This is wonderful. I'd like to start by just saying something I think a lot of us are feeling, and this is not meant to be a political statement, but the events over the last week, isn't it great to be an American?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think we're really, I think, in a wonderful situation. And our university also. We have a new president of the country, a new president of the university. I think we have a lot of excitement ahead. Now, I'd like to just start by telling a little story, and then I'll get kind of into some reminiscences of my days at Hopkins. But as a medical student back in the 70s, there was a commonly held view that only two members of any graduating class will become full professor at Johns Hopkins. And the story goes that the individual who's first in the class, because he or she would be so brilliant, they'd never want to let the individual out and keep the person at Hopkins. And then the person who's dead last in his or her class, because it would be an embarrassment if he or she got out. And in 1992, when I became full professor, I looked in the catalog, and they were right. There were only two of us who were full professors. Myself and Bert Vogelstein, the famous cancer researcher. And of course, Bert being the gentleman says, no, I was last in the class, but I don't think so. I don't think so. So alphabetically, I was first in my class. And alphabetically, Bert was near the end of the class, but whatever. So anyway, I thought I would share a few sort of tales from Lake Wobegon, so to speak. I grew up out in Minnesota. My parents were both the offspring of the Norwegian farming people from western Minnesota, eastern South Dakota, and grew up with the idea that science was fun. And that's in large part because of the influence of my parents. Mother never had a chance to go to college. She was a graduate from Twin Brooks High School, one of eight kids, had to sew her own underwear from flour sacks, and during the Depression when Granddad lost the farm, she had to support herself. From the age of 18 on. Dad's family was a little more prosperous, or I guess as they say in Baltimore, uppity. I mean, they were able to go. Dad and his sisters went to the University of Minnesota. They became an organic chemist, a chemistry professor. And when Mom and Dad met at a Luther League social, they fell in love and moved to Northfield, Minnesota, where Dad became the chairman of chemistry at St. Olaf College, a Norwegian school there. And Mom had babies, and they raised us, and they really actually put a lot of emphasis on education early on. Mother would always read to my brothers and sisters and me in the evenings, those cold, dark winter nights in Minnesota, and read the Children's Bible and all of the great books, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Treasure Island. And by the time we went to kindergarten, we knew a lot because of what we had at home. And Dad would teach us about numbers and science and geography. He would take my brothers and me up to his laboratory. We would do little experiments. Well, these weren't really experiments, but when you're 6 or 7 years old, you know, a drop of a colorless solution looks like water in another beaker, colorless solution looks like water. It turns bright pink. It's like amazing. And we learned about that, and it was fascinating. And our community, of course, it was a Norwegian community. The King of Norway would come. I think he got much better treatment in Northfield than he did in Norway. He'd be met at the train station and driven up to the college in the back of the only Cadillac in Northfield, owned by the town plumber. No, it wasn't Joe the plumber. I don't know. I think his name is Emil, actually. I remember in third grade, we were asked to draw a picture of what we would do when we grew up. I drew a picture of a chemist with test tubes because my dad was my hero. I thought I wanted to be a scientist like Dad. Although I noticed sitting beside me my good friend Jay Peterson, whose father was a professor of biology, and Jay was drawing a picture of a burglar. I always wondered what became of him. You know, do biology professors' kids become burglars? You know, Jay became a biologist like his dad. Well, I wondered for some time if he'd become a lobbyist or a congressman or something. Yeah, the other guy. So in 1957, in an October afternoon, Dad came over to get us from the Meadows. We were playing ball to come home for Sunday evening dinner, and he talked to us about something on the radio that had been announced. The Soviet Union had launched a satellite named Sputnik. and it was circling the world, and you know, we were kids, and what is this? But we knew that the Cold War was much discussed, and it was very widely viewed that, you know, the Soviet Union was culturally inferior, a godless nation, our adversaries, and here they had the first success in space. And an amazing thing happened because of that, and as children we didn't really pay that much attention, but the American public responded and supported massive investments in education, particularly education in science, math, and engineering. And actually science became increasingly a part of the public life. Television came to Minnesota in the 1950s. The most popular television program on Sunday night was the Disney Show. And of course, Disneyland, which was built in Anaheim, California in 1954, has four kingdoms, and the show reflected that. So you'd have one week, you'd have a fantasy show, which was a Donald Duck cartoon, and the next week would be Adventureland show, which would be like Tom Sawyer, and then the Frontierland, which would be Davy Crockett, and the fourth week would be Tomorrowland. And Tomorrowland was about science and technology. And so the children of America would be gathered around the television sets on Sunday evening, and they'd watch Wernher von Braun talking about rocketry, jet propulsion, and space exploration. Glenn Seaborg, the great Berkeley chemist, talked about chain reactions, the chemical chain reaction, atomic energy, with simple demonstrations that kids could understand. I remember Seaborg had a mouse trap with a ping pong ball, set it off, the ball flew, and then the camera comes to a room the size of this room, covered with mouse traps, each with a ping pong ball. He tosses one in, two, four. Within seconds, it's a cloud of flying mouse traps and ping pong balls. Everybody in America, all the children included, knew the name of Jonas Salk. We lived in a time where science was widely viewed as a positive and important part of our culture. And Dad responded by writing a National Science Foundation grant to go to University of California, Berkeley for a year. So we packed up the old station wagon. I guess we looked like the Norwegian equivalent of the Beverly Hillbillies. So we drove across country, six kids. And we lived there for a year, and it was a little bit like leaving Lake Wobegon to move to Sodom and Gomorrah. Berkeley was culturally heterogeneous. We were the only Norwegians. But we really learned a lot. And it was interesting because Dad met all the great Berkeley scientists, and some of them came to our house. His friend Linus Pauling would sometimes come up from Caltech, and he stayed with us. So we grew up in an amazing time, an amazing environment where science was emphasized. But like other youngsters, there's a period known as adolescence, you know, the wonder years. And so when I moved back to Minnesota, I myself took less and less interest in science. I was a Boy Scout, which is really a constructive thing. I learned a lot in Scouts and got involved in athletics and you know, had my fair share of trouble in school. But I remember distinctly in ninth grade when we had an assignment to do a chemical or a biological experiment for the class. I responded, as young boys often do, by procrastinating. And I just kind of ignored it until two nights before it was due. And then, of course, I panicked and said, "Dad, I need some help." And he was waiting for this. I mean, Dad was exuberant. He was kind of a Teddy Roosevelt type person. He said, "I have a good idea. You could demonstrate the relative reactivities of metals in water." And I thought, what? And you watch a nail rust? He says, "No, I have a great idea." So he brings home a little box, shoe box with test tubes with a solvent with little slivers of metal. And the object was to show how they would react in water. And of course, these were the alkali metals. Those of you who are chemists, if you remember the periodic table on the far left, at the top, number one, hydrogen, atomic number one. To the right, helium. Then goes back to the left, number three, lithium, atomic number three. And below that, sodium, atomic number 11, and below that potassium, number 19, and then below that's rubidium, but we didn't get to rubidium. So anyway, demonstrated to the class that lithium, a sliver of lithium in water, fizzes around like a little, maybe a crystal of bicarbonate in vinegar. It's kind of interesting, it's bubbling. And then I take the sliver of sodium out of the solvent and drop that onto the water, and shooting around like with a very bright yellow flare. And that's very interesting. The school kids are really fascinated. And then I get the sliver of potassium out and drop that. And of course, it explodes violently in a pink flare and shooting around. And the kids really amazed. And I didn't listen carefully when Dad explained how I end the experiment. So all went in the sink, kaboom. of course, the solvent was hexane, you know, basically like gasoline, and a flame shoots to the ceiling, and they had to repaint it. The sweater that my mother had carefully knitted for me for Christmas had little brown balls all in the front, and my eyebrows were burned off. But, you know, in a way, I think a scientist was born. Fortunately, he wasn't also burned to death. And it was really, I think, an idea of that science is interesting. And, of course, these role models at home, and particularly, I think, some of the clinical role models. A lot of dad's students, chemistry students, went on to become medical doctors. And in our community, there was a very strong presence of the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and there was the Norwegian medical missionaries. And that was really, I think, something I found very fascinating. And that's really what brought me to science, the idea of becoming a missionary doctor. And we knew people who had gone off to India or China or Africa for decades, and they'd come back, we'd see them. And that was a very powerful influence. So really, with that in mind, I wrote around to some of the medical schools and learned about Johns Hopkins, which was famous because of its international research in tropical diseases, a school of public health, and the medical school, and decided I would apply there. But I also applied to the University of Minnesota because the home state schools, you have a selective advantage. And anybody who's attended the University of Minnesota at that time knows that you also were required to take something called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. This MMPI exam is a very long, detailed psychological exam where they ask very personal questions. And then they ask them again, and apparently they know everything about you. And my interview at the University of Minnesota, I'll never forget, it went very well. I really tried hard when I was in college. I went to Augsburg College, where Dad taught a very fine, but not a selective school. It was a mostly working class kids. A lot of people had part-time jobs, but a very good scientific background. So I was applying, and I felt pretty confident things would go well. And so the interviewer then asked me if I had any questions. And I wanted to appear alert and very interested. So I said, well, what did you learn about me from that MMPI exam? Which is the wrong question, I can tell. So Dean Sullivan looks in the folder, looks at me straight in the eye, says, these results indicate that you lie more than average. Then he looks down again and looks at me, says, but you lie less than the average medical student. So our medical students there, help me out. What does that mean? I don't know. Anyway, in February of that year, I got a nice letter from Johns Hopkins inviting me to join the class of 1974. I'd been accepted, and you know, I was just euphoric. And this was just a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. Of course, my parents were not very favorable. I mean, my dad in particular, he wanted me where he could keep an eye on me. But my mind is made up, and I came out to Hopkins. And they were very generous. We were able to have a scholarship and some loans and be able to attend medical school. But I discovered something here which I thought was kind of interesting. And as I looked through the catalogs, I noticed every year the medical school would have a student from Minnesota, South Dakota, or North Dakota, every year. And I realized what this meant. To maintain a geographic diversity, they would have preferential admissions from people from parts of the country that they didn't see so often. I was an affirmative action candidate, really. And I never felt slighted by that. I was glad to be there. But I think it was actually a very nice thing about Hopkins, because they clearly could have taken students from New York City or LA or Washington with higher scores and grades and from more prestigious schools. But I think the diversity is something they felt added something important. And as a med student, I really, really had a great experience here. Go up to the Homewood campus oftentimes, and I still do, to use the gym and the swimming pool. I really enjoyed our time here. But I had a very particularly important experience when I got into the research laboratory. In the 1970s, the disease cholera was sweeping East Asia and South Asia. It's a horrible diarrheal disease. It kills children and small infants. In hours, they developed dehydration because of massive diarrhea. And a breakthrough had been generated here at Johns Hopkins by some scientists in the School of Public Health and the School of Medicine, Brad Sack, Nathaniel Pierce, Bucky Greeno, who developed a technique to rehydrate the patients. And so they had a research problem to identify the causes of horrible diarrheal diseases in Central America and South America, the so-called turistas. And so I worked in their lab, and it was really fascinating. Now, this was not a trendy subject. I remember going out to a mixer at Goucher College, and a very attractive young lady when I were talking, she said, "I understand you're a medical student." And I said, "Yes, I am." She asked me, "Well, what specialty do you think you'll select?" And I said, "Well, I'm really interested in diarrhea." It's like, end of the conversation. Like, this horrid look on her face. But, you know, it was, an interesting experience, and we succeeded isolating the toxin that causes the New World diarrhea. I felt gratified. It was very rewarding. But I think just as rewarding as the science itself was to meet the scientists, because I think we have a cultural problem in this country where scientists are viewed as sort of geeky, unusual people with kind of the crooked glasses and the messed up hair, like Christopher Lloyd in Back to the Future. And in fact, this was nothing like my experience. It was laboratory on the third floor of the Wood Basic Science Building. Had just really dramatic and colorful people from all over the world who left their homes to come to Johns Hopkins to do research. And they had really fascinating backgrounds. My roommate in med school, Van Bennett, was a big wave surfer from Hawaii who was an outstanding chemistry student at Stanford, but couldn't go to grad school because he would have been drafted, so as a medical student he did research. Morley Hollenberg was a Rhodes Scholar from Winnipeg, Guitel, a psychiatrist from Paris, Ignacio Sandoval, this jet black bearded intense Spanish anarchist who actually spent time in prison in Franco's Spain. He was there. He worked alongside Gianfredo Pucca, who was very handsome. In fact, my wife insists that Gianfredo is the handsomest man in the world, a patrician Italian born to a wealthy family. His father was a well-known academic neurologist who always said, "Gianfredo, you will be a scientist, you will be a doctor, you will be an academic." But Gianfredo was so handsome, he was identified by one of the famous Italian movie directors to play the role of a gigolo in one of his productions. And Gianfredo was also a champion downhill ski racer with a lithe figure. And his girlfriend, who he married, was the heiress to the Vespa fortune. So he became a billionaire, or at least a billion lira. And, what would someone like Gianfredo want to work on in a laboratory? But remember, he's Italian. He decided he would solve the molecular basis of femininity, the most important problem any Italian man could configure. And he succeeded. Do a Medline search. Pucca, Sica, Nola, and Bresciani, Nature, 1970. Isolation of the estrogen receptor by affinity chromatography. It was really an interesting time. And of course, when Gianfredo was in the lab, smoking was still allowed at Hopkins, and he wore these skin-tight trousers with no pockets, but he had a little gold cigarette lighter tucked in the top. And there was a constant stream of secretaries with unlit cigarettes sashaying down the hall. And Gianfredo would see them, he'd be there. So I kind of replanned my career thinking that medical research combined with clinical training is a great career. And to work on things like third world diseases at a laboratory bench where we can make developments that we could then take to the clinic was the most exciting thing I could imagine doing. And so I really went in that direction. And I also at that time met my wife, Mary, who was actually working with Diane Griffin, a new faculty member from Stanford. And Mary was Diane's first lab technician. And we've met and have been together ever since. So we did our clinical training out at Case Western, which was a Hopkins affiliate. Charles Carpenter from the cholera group was the chairman of medicine. I did more studies down at the University of North Carolina, working in the Wellcome Labs where Pedro Patricasas, another Hopkins person, was directing the research program. And then returned in 1981 to get some more training because I felt not really fully prepared scientifically to survive because basic science is very competitive. But things were working out. And we were working on red blood cell problems, and then we had actually a real family tragedy. We had two beautiful little daughters who were born in North Carolina, and were doing well. And then during Mary's third pregnancy, she had a premature separation of the placenta, and our daughter Lydia was born in profound shock and severe distress. And it was like a wake-up call. I was 34 years old, postdoctoral fellow, only to find that the postdoctoral fellowship healthcare insurance doesn't cover all the medical expenses. And the expenses to cover the cost of having a home duty nurse was 2 times my annual salary. It's like a very big kind of an awakening. And Mary kept the family organized and well, but I realized I needed a job. Really, I needed a job. And Dr. McCusick, bless him, he offered me a faculty position in the Department of Medicine. So I became a Hopkins faculty member and decided to redirect our research onto problems affecting neonates. And of course, I was not trained in neuroscience. Our daughter eventually died of the brain edema from the hypoxia. But I always wanted to work on this and look for inroads when we could. And we were having some success working on the Rh blood group antigen, which is another problem of neonates, which was actually not understood at a molecular level, and made a chance observation of a protein which contaminated our Rh preps. And this protein was of similar size, and it was very curious. And it turned out this is the first known molecular water channel, the aquaporin-1 protein. Now, those of you who are in science may be somewhat familiar with the problems in physiology of fluid transport. Our bodies will secrete spinal fluid and tears and saliva that fill our orbits of our eyes with aqueous humor, will humidify our airways, will concentrate our urine. If you don't think that's important, next time you're on an airliner with a full bladder and the seatbelt light goes on, think of aquaporin 2. And these are present in plants. They're ubiquitous in all life forms. It explains how water is drawn up from the ground by plants, how they can transpire. And there was a lot of scientific interest in this. And of course, we're a small lab over in the 10th floor of the Blaylock building initially, and then over in basic sciences. Never a large group, and the interest got increasingly large, and I would be invited periodically to give lectures in Sweden, which is a clue of sorts. And in fact, every year I would get an invitation to speak at some special lecture in Sweden. And oftentimes to save money, I'd fly, you know, economy minus. Arriving, you know, after an all-night flight in Orlando. And I remember distinctly one occasion, we're waiting behind the business class passengers going through the pass control. And they would, you know, coat and tie, properly dressed. The pass control officer would ask each gentleman the purpose of his visit to Sweden. He'd say business. He'd stamp the passport. And he'd look at me in disheveled corduroys and kind of looked like I hadn't slept all night because I hadn't. He looked at me and said, "What's the purpose of your visit in Sweden?" And I said, "Well, I'm here to present the Karolinska Research Lecture." Karolinska is the medical school in Stockholm that awards the Nobel Prize. And the man looked at me. He says, "Are you nervous?" I said, "Well, yes, I am a bit nervous." And he says, "You should be." So it's, I guess, 3 or 4 years later, then early in the morning, the phone rings. And it's a Swedish voice, very serious voice. "This is an important telephone call from Stockholm for Professor Peter Agri. Are you Professor Agri?" I said, "I sure am." And he proceeded to inform me that I'd share the Nobel Prize in Chemistry with Roderick MacKinnon. And MacKinnon actually is also, like myself, a medical doctor. He's up at Rockefeller. And of course, the first thoughts were euphoria. And then I started to have a little apprehension. Is this when I tell the Nobel Committee that I got a D in high school chemistry? I decided to just say thank you. And Mary, much quicker than I am, ran for her cell phone, called my mother. Dad had died 8 years before. Mother was living alone back in Minnesota, and awakened her early in the morning to explain what was happening. And mother, a good South Dakota farm girl, again, never university educated, but very thoughtful, very wise in the ways of the world. She thought for a moment. She said, "Mary, that's very nice, but tell Peter not to let this go to his head." I guess this is good advice. This is actually the headline in the Washington Post, "Nobel Mother's Advice." So, but by the time I got to the lab in later that morning, it had gone to the heads of the young people. They'd drained several bottles of champagne before I got in. And the most amazing thing of all, of course, President Brody came over to see me. You know, I had no idea we were such close personal friends. And when I went to the office that the voicemail was jammed with requests for interviews. And I went through them one at a time, Lehrer Newshour, New York Times. And then one of our colleagues, a familiar voice from Norway, one of our neuroscience colleagues, it was so excited, his voice, he said, "Peter, Peter, we've just heard the news. It's unbelievable." And then there's a pause. And the voice comes on again. It's believable. It's wonderful. And as I drove home that evening, the Marquee and the Wells Liquor Store on York Road, the discount liquor store, the sign says, "Congrats, Dr. Agri." It's like, whoa. So it's sort of a career-changing experience. We went to Stockholm, and of course we have four children. We have a son-in-law. I have five brothers and sisters, my mother, and you're only allowed a small number of tickets for the Nobel event. But I was able to get two tickets for my chairman at Hopkins, Dr. McCusick, and Ann McCusick came with, and Dr. Dan Lane from the Department of Biochemistry, which I joined subsequently, and his wife Pat came. And it was a wonderful event. I mean, it was like never-ending parties. But it sort of changes things in a way. And we had answered, I think, the major questions we sought to answer in terms of the aquaporins. Of course, there are plenty of new things, but there are plenty of new scientists working on it. And I decided I would like to use the bully pulpit to advance science in a more direct way as like a cheerleader or ambassador for science, because what happens with a Nobel is you're invited by everybody you've ever met to every university, and the news media is very interested in what you have to say. So the object is to do something responsible and constructive. And I decided I would try to use this as an ambassador for science. And that's what prompted the move to Duke. They gave me a very generous offer. And as a basic scientist, you know, we didn't have a lot of money saved. That was nice. But after a couple of years there, I really missed Hopkins and Diane Griffin and Al Sommer. And then subsequently Mike Clagg from the School of Public Health asked me if I'd come back and direct the Malaria Institute at the School of Public Health. Now, I'd always wanted to work on malaria, and we had started some work in our lab on malaria. We're not expert malaria scientists, but this is just consistent with what I always wanted to do. And so after I'd fulfilled my commitment at Duke, actually while I was down there, I'd come home on weekends, because our youngest, Carly, was a junior, then a senior at Towson High School, so we had our home here. I'd come home on weekends. And Hopkins was very, very gracious. The Department of Biochemistry had a little office for me as a visiting professor. And it was always wonderful to come back. As I'd walk by the front guard station, the basic scientists, and the guards, they knew me. "Dr. Agri, you're back." It was like, just made me feel good. And so the opportunity to return came. I accepted it with great enthusiasm. And we're now at work trying to cure malaria. It's a horrible disease. Kills between 1 and 3 million children a year in Africa. More than a half a billion people will develop malaria this year, and it's very important that we get a handle on malaria. The existing medicines are becoming less and less effective due to drug resistance. There's a lot of money available for aid for the developing countries, but that's like first aid, bed nets, spraying DDT in doorways. That'll keep the mosquitoes away for now. But a few years from now, the nets are gone, the malaria is back. And so a very generous Hopkins alumnus, an anonymous donor, has given a large gift to the School of Public Health to make sure that at times of difficulty with the federal funding that we can keep the work going. We've now recruited 15 full-time malaria scientists and about a dozen or so who are working part-time on malaria. And we're having a really great time. So I think that's my Hopkins story. It's really been a wonderful to be associated with Hopkins, and this is, I guess, 38 years after I started medical school. It's been a big part of my life, and it always will. I think Hopkins is a special place because we're not the biggest university, we're not the richest university in many ways, but maybe we're the richest in family. I think we have the opportunity of doing your best work and getting people to help you, to recruit young people, to get other faculty members to help you. And I can't imagine that being as easy to do anywhere else. So with that, I guess they're supposed to answer some questions. Thank you for coming to the lunch. I'm glad to be here. And if you have something you'd like to ask me, I'll do my best to answer it. Sorry for the voice. I lecture and run out of voice.
Any clinical collaborative work with Gary Posner in the chemistry department. I know Gary's yes. doing.
Yeah, thank you. Gary Posner is an outstanding chemist at the Homewood campus, who's part of our malaria research institute. He is designing novel compounds based on some existing malaria medicines derived from the artemisinin, a series of compounds which are found by Chinese folk medicine to have anti-malarial properties. And Gary has designed excellent derivatives which are much more potent. And we're very optimistic that that's going to be the next line of medicines coming right here from Johns Hopkins, from Gary's lab.
Talk about the Senate.
Oh, the Senate. Well, all right. So, there's much discussion of my look into running for the U.S. Senate from Minnesota. I never announced I would run. I looked into it and explored it and did so for a few reasons. I love my day job. It's not that. But we have representation in the U.S. Senate of business, of law. But there are no scientists. There never have been. And I think right now, science needs representation in our government. We're in an era where a lot of the big challenges, whether this is energy independence or global warming, provision of health care or education, there is a scientific base to it. And so actually, there are some good friends back in Minnesota. I've been a resident in Maryland now for decades, but I have a pretty well-known back there, and Vice President Mondale is amongst our family friends, and they encouraged me to look into it, and I did. And what was very interesting, as a scientist, how do you decide a new line of work is practical? You do a pilot experiment. You do small-scale experiments and see what the outcome is. So after talking to a lot of people and getting a lot of encouragement from citizens, but no encouragement from the party, I'm a Democrat, decided to do a poll. And it was interesting. The poll showed, by name alone, the incumbent senator from Minnesota, Norman Coleman, has had a very difficult time. He changed parties. He's not well-liked in Minnesota, and he was a very strong George Bush advocate. Now he's turned away, and the public doesn't like him. So by name alone, I was like 5 points behind Coleman, which I was pretty astonished. I suspect generic candidate X, Y, or Z would have been 6 points behind him. But then this is where the value of polls, because in politics, as I've learned, it's all about getting your message out. And if you're true with the message, and everybody knows it, a subsequent poll will show how far you've gone. And so, born and raised in Northfield, Minnesota, there's an uptick and a point or so. And graduate of Johns Hopkins Medical School, a career in medical research, there was a big uptake. I overtook the incumbent, meaning the public would like to see people from sciences, the health sciences, involved in government. Then enlisted, I won the Nobel Prize. There was no other uptake. That was not important. I think it's the career, the devotion to health problems that the public sees as important. I chose not to step in because it was a matter of could I raise the money without inside help, and I felt it was unlikely I could succeed. And the opportunity of directing the Malaria Institute, I thought, well, that's something that is more important to me. So I didn't step in. As far as I can tell right now, the election out in Minnesota is a tie. We have two people actually from New York City who ran for the Senate. Wow. And the third party candidate, who's a bus driver, got 15% of the vote. So it's quite clear the public is not overjoyed with their choices. But I think it is important to get involved in public life. And the Senate sounds like kind of a glorious ambition, but I think there are other ways to serve in the local government, school boards, or just being involved in the community, as we always have. Mary would always volunteer over at Stoneley Elementary School and did my share of science demonstrations. And I think there are a lot of ways we as scientists need to bring our work to the public. So I don't anticipate running for office, but I did look.
We can start a campaign.
Well, you're very kind. The election's over.
Well, next time.
Thanks. Anything else you'd like to? Yes, please.
Could you talk a little bit about the approach of the Malaria Institute as compared with other universities
sure.
across the country and their efforts to do something about malaria?
Mm-hmm. Well, so malaria is one of the world's biggest diseases in terms of morbidity and mortality, but it's not a disease of great concern within the United States. We had malaria in the United States, Historians believe that malaria was a leading cause of morbidity for Union troops during the Civil War, malaria being endemic in the South. But the advanced public health standards, draining of standing water, screen porches, building houses away from swampy areas, has led to the disappearance of malaria in the United States. The invention of DDT helped. So malaria is not a problem here, and federal funding for research on malaria is small. There are researchers at a number of universities. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, which is originally a malaria laboratory, has minimal malaria activity now because it's not a problem within the United States. Now, of course, we also have great respect and concern for the less fortunate on the earth. And this has always been, I think, the mission of Johns Hopkins, particularly the School of Public Health. And so because of the private benevolence of our donor, we were able to start a malaria research institute at a large scale. There is no other malaria research institute of this size in the country. There are a few programs with three or four malaria workers in Seattle and Boston, and they're doing great work. They're wonderful people. They don't have the resources. The program that we have a malaria research station in rural Zambia affiliated with the Macha Missionary Hospital there. And we've got a program we're now developing in Bangladesh. And so we actually have a lot of advantages here at Hopkins because of our international presence. And so to develop a program like that at Hopkins was basically a sure thing once we had the financial resources. And it's going well, but it's a very difficult problem. The malaria organism has been around for hundreds of millions of years. There are malaria organisms specific for most different mammals as well as birds and reptiles. It's very wily. The genome of a malaria parasite has about a third as many genes as we do. So it's not a simple target. The existing medicines for a long time, the quinine, these are not successful any longer because of drug resistance. So the challenge is large. But I think one of the reasons I lecture a lot around the country, around the world, is to get the word out that the young people who are planning careers in the life sciences could work on anything, cancer, neuroscience. There are a lot of important problems to work on, but I'd like to at least see some of them coming here to Hopkins to work on malaria and other tropical diseases. And so I'm mercilessly trying to recruit while I'm on the road. We need the best and the brightest. We've always benefited from that. Any other comments or? Oh, yes, sir.
Do you have any trouble with the politics in Africa and completing your mission?
You raise a very important point, because Africa is a patchwork of different countries, some with good governance, some with terrible governance. And in Zambia, where we have our program, we have a stable situation. There was just an election of a new president, I should know his name, Levi Mwanawasa, the president who was highly respected, died of a stroke. And so there's been an election. Things are tranquil, things are organized, and they have good governance. We're in good shape. Now, Zambia, as those of you who've studied history know, is the former northern Rhodesia. Southern Rhodesia, which is known as Zimbabwe, is geographically, culturally, and botanically identical, but it has terrible governance. And of course, the malaria control programs in Zimbabwe have deteriorated badly. And you know, the mosquitoes don't know which side of the Zambezi River they're on. So in fact, bad governance in an adjacent country does affect the situation in Zambia. But it gives us hope. If they had good governance in all of the countries in Africa, and we could get a handle on these diseases, these people would lift themselves out of poverty. Visiting rural Zambia is really interesting. And of course, these rural families have, by our standards, almost nothing. But when you see the little children that may be wearing a tattered t-shirt cast off years ago by an American or European, if they have good health, they're happy. You don't have to be rich to be happy. But I think when the health is bad, it's very difficult. And so I think the governance is a problem in many parts of Africa. And other parts of the world as well, including North America, there have been some problems. But this is an issue. And so I think actually science and medicine are going to be part of diplomacy. And that's something I've found from my experience at Hopkins. People come from different cultures. I didn't describe it in Pedro's lab where Gianfredo and Ignacio were working one summer. A brilliant young scientist came from Beirut, Lebanon, Naji Sehun. He's probably the most brilliant scientist I've ever met. But Naji carried a lot of hatred. He was a Palestinian, raised in a Palestinian refugee camp. And he shared with me that he thought Israelis were all Zionists, evil people. He suspected all American Jews were Zionist sympathizers. He'd never met any American Jews. And while he was here working on the lab bench alongside Marvin Siegel, this jovial grandson of a rabbi from Brooklyn, New York, he became the best friends with Marvin. I think countries and governments sometimes can get together around a problem, like a health problem or a scientific problem, and make inroads that they couldn't otherwise do. So one of my things, I didn't talk about this, but I chaired the Committee on Human Rights for the National Academy of Sciences, is to do just that, to meet with governments that are imprisoning or persecuting scientists, health professionals around the world, and to get them to do the positive thing by saving face. And so governance, I think, is an important thing. And I think we have actually a unique approach. So I'd like to think in the future, in addition to State Department diplomacy, we'll have science and health diplomats, those of us who have colleagues all around the world, and could convince people to do the right thing. Yes, sir?
How about DDT today?
Mm-hmm.
Is that of value?
Sure. Excellent question. DDT. You know, a Nobel Prize was awarded to the Swiss chemists who invented DDT because it's such a potent insecticide. It's valuable, and of course it was led to the near eradication of malaria in Ceylon, Sri Lanka. But it was not used judiciously. It's very toxic to the environment when it's used in enormous doses. So basically industrial levels of DDT were being released everywhere, and the Anopheles mosquito that carries malaria is very sensitive. Now, DDT was basically banned because of its toxic effects upon the environment, the outcome of the Silent Spring and the other environmental work. But it's now recognized that DDT does have a role because it's very potent if used in tiny doses around doorways and windows in sleeping areas. And bed nets to prevent people from being bitten by mosquitoes at night are soaked in different insecticides at very low doses, but they can be used effectively. So I think DDT has a big role, but it's going to have to be used very carefully. Yes, please.
As a child growing up in Jamaica, close by the river, I was very familiar with malaria and quinine and the need to spray rivers and oil rivers. But I was always fascinated by being taught that the female Anopheles was the culprit.
Yes.
Is that a fact?
Yes.
Just the female?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So the biology of this is something that our scientists at the School of Public Health are working on, and they're probably our most successful scientists. Marcelo Jacobs, Lorena, Jason Rascon, George Demopoulos are doing basic science studies on insects. And what they're finding is, first off, it's true. It is the female Anopheles of some species, not all Anopheles, but Anopheles arabiensis, Anopheles gambiae are the species that are most dreaded because of malaria. And the female mosquito during egg development needs the proteins from a blood meal to have effective oocyte genesis. So, in fact, it's the female that does pass on the malaria. And so, of course, by treating the waterways as you described, with fairly rudimentary methods, you can reduce the prevalence of these mosquitoes. But, you know, they're still there, and they will come back. And oftentimes what happens is malaria will come back at times of great social turbulence, with refugee populations, or when the health protection is at its minimum. So that's the problem with malaria in the past is, it looked like it was under control, and relaxation led to a resurgence. And that's something we have to be able to deal with.
Question back. He's been trying.
I'm sorry. Another question? Yes, sir.
I heard a talk by the head of USAID, and he was talking about the challenge of eliminating AIDS disease. He indicated that great success came in talking to finance ministers in government opposed to health ministers. And in fact, as they raised it up to a higher level, they had more success in getting attention. Have you seen the same thing with these tropical diseases?
Sure. Well, I think this is an excellent point. I don't personally meet with government finance ministers. I'd love to, but I have not had occasion. But I think the effects on the economy are devastating. In short, the people in the poorest parts of Africa, so malaria coexists where the poverty is the greatest. And they're sick because they're poor, and they're poor because they're sick. And to economically emerge from this, we have to get a handle. Because if a large fraction of the population is sick, and people get malaria repeatedly, the average five-year-old in rural Zambia has had falciparum malaria, the deadliest form, 12 times on average. And with each infection and survival, a little bit of resistance emerges. But there are other consequences with loss of hearing, loss of vision. So in fact, it's a dreadful economic significance. And we're talking, again, more than a half a billion people getting malaria. It's a huge drain on the economy. Imagine if we had half or two-thirds of our workforce in the United States home with influenza half or two-thirds of the year. That's what it would be like.
Yep.
Yes, sir. Oh, Mahmoud.
I wonder if you can share with us your thoughts about access to health, and about the education of health professionals, especially nursing and medical students.
Well, access to health is excellent for most of us in the United States, but the uninsured are a big problem, and it's also an economic drain on our country. As we try to develop systems that are more efficient, and I think this is going to be a very high priority for the new government, I think it's going to be important that all parties participate. What I'd like to propose is that the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences get involved in the design of healthcare. So it's not only the healthcare industry, the pharmaceutical companies, the insurance companies, or the trial lawyers. The fact is, healthcare is something that affects all of us, and to design good systems. Now, in my travels, I see a variety of differences. There's a little island country that you've all heard of, Singapore. Singapore has no natural resources except for the intelligence and hard work of its citizens. Yet they maintain a standard of living equivalent to Switzerland. They have two government healthcare programs which compete and are able to provide full healthcare for their citizens by spending only 3.5% of the GDP. We spend 17% and we're not. So the problems have been solved. Now, we're not Switzerland, we're not Canada, but I think we could pick and choose elements that would work. I think it's something that is going to be looked at ever so closely now, and I think that the time has come where we provide health care for everybody. And of course, there is personal responsibility needed. But I think it's hard to argue that children are personally responsible for their lack of health care. Yes, sir.
I remember 10 years or more ago, I read somewhere that of all the people that ever lived, over half died from malaria.
That's right.
It was the biggest killer.
That's right.
Heard,
yeah, I've read that. I don't know if it's completely accurate. This was... National Geographic had an issue on malaria about a year and a quarter ago, and it was mentioned there.
Yeah.
I believe it's probably correct.
It's from the figures that we read about, it certainly seems plausible.
Sure. On the other hand, the fact that we have eradicated malaria from the United States shows that it can be done. And the way this was done was actually before high tech. Now, so with high tech methods, and the resources, we should be able to get there. But the complexity is that you don't just have one population of people with malaria, another population with tuberculosis, and another population who have HIV positive. It's actually all the same people. And so they're weakened from a number of different diseases that are concurrent.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you.